This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. 2022 was the year that the United States surpassed 1 million deaths due to COVID-19. At the same time, rates of routine vaccinations for young children continued to decrease. It was also the eighth year in a row that the U.S. had 10 or more separate weather-related disasters with damages totaling $1 billion or more. In its new report, Ready or Not 2023, Protecting the Public's Health from Diseases, Disasters, and Bioterrorism, Trust for America's Health measures how prepared states are for a range of public health emergencies. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss the rankings of Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, and public health preparedness in Greater Cincinnati are Trust for America's Health President and CEO, Dr. Nadine Gracia. Welcome, Dr. Gracia.
Thank you, Lucy. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And the Health Collaborative Vice President for Clinical Strategies, Tiffany Mattingly. Thanks for being here, Tiffany.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you.
Dr. Gracia, let's start by talking about what do we all need to know about this study? What are the kind of major takeaways that you want people to understand from this report?
Yes, thank you, Lucy. As you noted, the Ready or Not report is an annual assessment that Trust for America's Health publishes to help describe the nation's level of public health preparedness and also includes within that measuring states' readiness to respond to an emergency, really to look at the capabilities that are foundational to public health preparedness and response. You know, what we've seen at a national level and what we find in this year's report is that there are areas of strong performance across the nation where a majority of states have made preparations and have plans to expand their healthcare capacity during a time of emergency. They also have plans to expand their public health laboratory capacity to be able to increase testing, for example, during times of an emergency. Most states are also accredited in the areas of public health and emergency management. Some states are accredited in both. And what we also find that there are also opportunities for improvement. We see that too few people are being vaccinated, for example, against seasonal flu each year. And during the 2021 to 2022 flu season, we had about 51% of Americans ages 6 months and older who received a flu vaccine, where our national targets are really at 70%. So we are still continue to trend below the national target. We also see, for example, that only about half of the U.S. population is served by a comprehensive public health system. And that really ties into many of the recommendations that this report has that we can discuss certainly later in the program.
Okay. Clearly, the COVID-19 pandemic has been a massive public health emergency, but preparedness is important for other kinds of disasters, too, as your report points out. What has the pandemic really exposed about the flaws in our public health preparedness systems?
Well, indeed, you know, we have seen this through COVID-19. We've seen it in other public health emergencies before the COVID-19 pandemic. One has been really the chronic underfunding of the public health system at all levels, at the federal, state, and local levels. What that has translated to is having an infrastructure, for example, with regards to our data systems. And many of our data systems are really outdated and a need to modernize those data systems. We also have a shortage of the public health workforce. There's a recent study that showed that we need about an additional 80,000 full-time equivalent positions at the state and local health departments to be able to provide a minimum set of basic public health services. And, you know, public health workers are truly the front line of protecting and promoting health. And yet what we saw and have seen during the pandemic is how public health and the workforce has been frequently attacked or harassed, and disturbingly, even with those trends we were having before, another study showed that nearly half of state and local public health employees left their jobs between 2017 and 2021. Thirdly, I'll say an area that the pandemic has really exposed and further exacerbated are health disparities. There are longstanding health disparities that have impacted far too many communities across the country, that really have existed for many, many decades. And we see that not only in health, but also in economic terms, as far as housing and transportation, access to economic opportunity and food security. Those are critical issues that also impact health and well-being and preparedness for communities that need to be addressed.
Definitely want to come back to that later. Tiffany, the Health Collaborative has been working for years to plan and be ready for health public health emergencies locally in the greater Cincinnati area. But the COVID-19 pandemic seems unlike anything you could have possibly planned for. Talk about how local public health systems reacted to the pandemic and what the strengths and weaknesses were here.
That's exactly right. This was very unprecedented, and I know that word is overused at this point. The gravitas of that meaning is diminished, but it was a time that all of our planning and all of our thoughtful exercises and the check boxes that we went through and the processes that were developed, completed simulations, all of that work, while incredibly important, did not 100% align to a true chronic disaster that we were experiencing. And so our ability to mobilize was hindered because we couldn't just pull plans off the shelf and activate. We needed to pull plans off the shelf, reevaluate, recalibrate, bring new people to the table, and determine what we needed to do next. And it was nothing that we had ever truly planned for. We run Ebola exercises. We have a plan in place for that. We've never had to fully execute it in a large scale, which is something very different than sending one patient from one hospital to the next to make sure that they are receiving care in the appropriate place for the Ebola virus. So, you know, there was just so many differences in the magnitude of this response. And public health was at the table from day one. And they were, we are, as many states and regions have a disaster preparedness coalition. We are funded by the state to run this coalition. And so we were able to bring together really right out of the gate a multi-agency coalition, including public health. But as Dr. Gracia mentioned, you know, public health very quickly had a stigma that was really difficult to break through. And I think when she speaks to this, to some of the improvements, that collaboration, that public collaboration up front, is so important to help include the public in the planning and in the knowledge as we are receiving it.
Mm. Dr. Grasse, your report ranks the states in terms of how well prepared they are for these public health emergencies. Ohio ranked the highest out of Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. Talk about the strengths and weaknesses of each state and where they ranked in your evaluation.
Sure, Lucy. So as you noted, we do have the performance categories, and I'll start by saying that for any state, you know, whether they're in high performing, middle or low performance tiers, there are always opportunities for improvement. There are strengths we see in the states, but we recognize this is a continuous process, and you heard Ms. Mattingly really talk about some of the areas that they in particular had worked on in response to the pandemic. When we look at Ohio specifically, some of its strengths is one, having a plans in place with regards to expanding its healthcare capacity in terms of an emergency, as well as having similar plans for its public health laboratories to be able to do what we call that surge to increase testing and expand their testing capabilities during times of emergency. Ohio also has accreditation both in public health and emergency management. Where there are opportunities for improvement include, for example, flu vaccination rates. You know, the state is about at 49% with regards to flu vaccination rates, a percent of residents. And as I mentioned earlier, the national target is 70%. And so that ongoing outreach by the state to encourage people who are eligible to get vaccinated is important. We also look at measures like paid time off and the percentage of employed individuals who are using paid time off, because we know that's an important way to have infection control. If someone is ill, not having to go to work, so having the ability to have paid time off so they won't lose income or lose their jobs, that's also an area, an opportunity for improvement. With regards to the state of Kentucky is in the low performance tier. Now, I say that But recognize too, that doesn't mean that the state is not prepared for a disaster or any type of emergency. But again, that there are opportunities for the state, for example, within accreditation and with regards to the percentage of hospitals that have the top quality rating, there are opportunities for the state to continue the enhancements to be able to respond to a whole host of public health emergencies. And then specifically Indiana. Indiana is in the middle tier. Again, opportunities for the state to be able to have some improvement areas, for example, in emergency management, accreditation. Similarly, with regards to having policies that support paid time off for individuals who need to take time off if they're ill or to take care of a loved one, as well as looking at seasonal flu vaccination rates. Again, an area that many of the states across the country can improve, because we've actually seen a concerning trend of a decline of routine vaccinations during the COVID-19 pandemic. And so really wanting to restore, back to pre-pandemic levels, but it can further increasing vaccination rates so that we can work to control infectious disease outbreaks.
I want to remind our listeners, we're talking in this recorded interview about emergency health preparedness in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana with Trust for America's Health President and CEO, Dr. Nadine Gracia, and the Health Collaborative Vice President for Clinical Strategies, Tiffany Mattingly. Tiffany, Dr. Gracia referenced this earlier, but this report does have a section on the intersection between community resilience, emergency preparedness, and health equity. How did all of that play out locally in our region?
Yeah, that's a great question. The pandemic really magnified what we knew was in place already with health disparities. And so we were really able to dive into making sure that we were doing everything we could to break down language barriers, health literacy, that we could get into neighborhoods and provide access to testing and to vaccination. The greater Cincinnati area and Hamilton County did a wonderful job funding a program called Test and Protect that was run by the Health Collaborative to help provide equitable, no-cost access to testing, to make sure that everyone across the county could receive those testing resources. In addition to that, receive resources they needed to isolate and quarantine if they needed to stay sick at home or to be in quarantine for a period of time, that they had access to food and the resources they needed, including connections to Job and Family Services and other community resources to help support them during this time.
Dr. Gracia, what are the big takeaways when it comes to the intersection between emerging preparedness, emergency preparedness, and health equity? I mean, what's the most important step when it comes to really addressing the disparities we see across the nation?
Thank you for that question. I think Ms. Mattingly just gave you such an excellent description of exactly how you approach this. It's one, really partnering with communities, not planning for them, but planning with as partners and working with community leaders from community-based organizations, faith-based organizations, schools and institutions of higher education, clinics and hospitals, as well as with public health, to really be able to have this kind of multi-sectoral approach towards the planning and preparing for public health emergencies, as well as the response to them. And then in tailoring that response and recognizing where are the places that that community members trust and bringing services to the community, being responsive to their needs, and also recognizing who are the most effective messengers. You know, it's going to be public health officials, but also community leaders who can be doing the outreach and education, especially for something, for example, such as a vaccination campaign, to be able to address and answer questions, just recognizing who and are trusted messengers, and ensuring that those community partners also have resources. Often we ask our community partners to do things without the funding and resources available to do those efforts. And so ensuring that there are investments made to be able to support those efforts. We also have the opportunity, and we've seen this certainly at the federal level, but also around the country, is having a designated chief health equity officer who is part of that emergency planning and response, who's part of the leadership and within the governmental structures, to be able to really look at and analyze data. And we need to certainly assure that we have data that really are disaggregated, where it's describing communities that are most impacted by an emergency, so that, again, we can target our resources to the communities that are most in need. And then it's recognizing, and Ms. Mattingly spoke to it, that it's not only meeting the health needs, but there are also a lot of social and economic needs that happen within these emergencies. We saw the long lines of cars and individuals who were waiting to be able to get access to food from food banks. Food insecurity is a significant issue. Having access to affordable housing and recognizing that housing may be a challenge during the time of an emergency, as well as assuring that those who are employed, who may be in essential jobs, are they getting access to, whether it's paid time off, having access to the types of equipment that can protect them in the emergency, and transportation to get them to where they need to go. Being able to address those broader social and economic conditions are critical. And it's not just critical during the emergency, but also beyond the crisis. We have to address those longstanding structural barriers where far too many communities don't have access to healthy, affordable foods, don't have access to the type of economic opportunity that really makes them more resilient during a time of emergency. So building those relationships prior to the crisis and keeping those relationships going beyond the crisis, so that you build and earn the trust of the community.
Dr. Grassi, I want to circle back to something you've brought up several times, and that's vaccines, vaccination rates. And you're talking not only about COVID-19 vaccinations, but also flu vaccines and other vaccines that are, you know, are in the public's interest that more people get. What do you ascribe this reluctance to? Why do you think these vaccination rates are going down?
It's an important question, and certainly one that concerns us with regards to seeing rates of vaccination, whether it's routine childhood immunizations declining. You know, initially in the pandemic, certainly with when there was a time of the physical isolation and stay at home directives that were there to really protect and promote the public's health, that, you know, children may have not been seeing their primary care physicians as routinely, to then be able to access have access to routine vaccinations. But we've seen that persist. And some of this is concern about some misinformation as well that even existed before the pandemic. But certainly we've seen that heighten through the pandemic around misinformation as it relates to vaccines and potential adverse effects of vaccines. And so it's critically important that we really work to continue to build the public's trust and confidence in vaccinations, because vaccines are truly one of the most effective public health tools to be able to prevent illness and prevent deaths. And we saw a great example of this in the state of Ohio with the measles outbreak that took place that sickened about 85 children who were largely unvaccinated, had not completed the full vaccination series for measles. And the local health departments, state health department in Ohio, working in collaboration with the CDC, did immediate contact tracing, working to do outreach and education, implementing vaccination campaigns. And this is where we can talk about success of public health, is being able to contain that outbreak with that outbreak having ended. And so that's the demonstration of what the effectiveness of public health. And they're doing this all the while still managing through the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, now still with the concern around the train derailment. Public health has to respond to multiple issues across various public health threats to communities. And that's why it's so important to invest in and ensure we have a strong and robust public health system.
Dr. Grassi, you mentioned before that even the states in the highest tier of your report have room for improvement. What do you hope to see states and the federal government do in response to this information? How do you expect or hope your report will be used?
Well, thank you for that question. One, we need to invest in public health because of the critical nature and work that public health does each and every day, not only during emergencies, but every day to promote health and well-being. You're hearing the clear examples from Ms. Mattingly of the ways in which they are serving the community. But if you look at our nation's spending, we invest, we have about $4.3 trillion in health expenditures annually, and yet only about 3 to 5% of that goes to public health and prevention. And so we hope that this report can really serve as a call to action with some actionable data and recommend evidence-based policy recommendations that, one, will really address Congress and state and local governments meeting the need to ensure that there is the funding necessary to strengthen our nation's public health infrastructure. We have to really invest in assuring that we know that emergency funding, for example, that's come through the COVID-19 legislation has been very important. But emergency funding is just that. It's short term and it's not sustained. And so ensuring that we're having sustained and sufficient funding for public health so that we can modernize our data systems, so that public health can hire the workforce that is needed to meet all of these public health services is critically important. We've been talking about communications. Congress and state legislatures should also be really investing in these programs that are helping to counter misinformation and disinformation, that we need to have effective public health communications, and also protect the public health authorities. We have seen a disturbing trend where more than half of states have been introducing or enacted legislation that is actually restricting or removing authorities from public health, and understanding that public health is there to really follow the science and implement policies and practices that are going to be in the best interests of the public's health. And so certainly supporting public health in that regard to have those authorities are critical. And then we also need to have advanced policies and invest in programs that really address those broader social and economic conditions that help support community resiliency, whether it's access to healthcare, access to quality education, looking at affordable housing and the quality of housing, economic opportunity, ensuring that there's availability of public transportation. All of these things really play into the health and well-being of communities. So these are some critical steps that policymakers at the federal, state, and local levels can be taking. And a first step is really in looking at our investment in public health. Public health experts have estimated that we have about a $4.5 billion annual shortfall as it relates to foundational public health funding. We hope that this COVID-19 pandemic will really serve as that clarion call for action to truly finally invest in the public health system and modernize the system to be able to respond to the growing public health threats that we face as a nation.
I've been talking with Trust for America's Health President and CEO, Dr. Nadine Gracia, and the Health Collaborative Vice President for Clinical Strategies, Tiffany Mattingly. Thank you both so much for your time today. You can find a link on the website to the new report by Trust for America's Health called Ready or Not 2023, Protecting the Public's Health from Diseases, Disasters, and Bioterrorism. That link is on our website, wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May.